When we talk about Somalia on this program, the news is often about warlords and violence, or as we heard earlier, pirates hijacking ships off the coast. Well, here's a different kind of Somali news. A rapper named Kanan is trying to change the way his country is viewed. He's become an artist to watch in the world of hip-hop. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Kanan grew up in Mogadishu on what he calls the meanest streets in the universe. In one song on his new CD, he calls his hometown the Risky Zone, full of pistols and Russian revolvers.
The song's called ABCs, and it's about how, being born in a certain place, it changes everything in your destiny. When you hear the song, I got the kids' choir singing, "They don't teach us the ABCs, we play on the hard concrete. All we got is life on the streets." And for us, that is very true. You know?
Somalia is one of the poorest and most violent countries in the world. Malnutrition and clan warfare are rampant. According to Amnesty International, some 6,000 civilians were killed in fighting in 2007 alone. Kanan wants to use his music to raise consciousness about what's happening there.
The people of Somalia just do not have a voice. They are, to me, the most forgotten people in the world.
Heaven, is there a chance that you could come down?
Kanan left Somalia in 1991 with his mother and older brother. He was a teenager. The country was in a civil war with multiple factions fighting each other.
Mogadishu was burning, and the government had is falling, and all the embassies are packing out. And my mother is able to get visas to the United States.
She got visas for herself, Kanan, his older brother, and his cousin, who Kanan says was his best friend. But in the end, his mother could only afford 3 plane tickets and had to tell Kanan's cousin she couldn't take him.
My mother tried to get us out, planned it to the last detail, except the plane got derailed because there wasn't enough money for the plane tickets. How bitter when my mother had to choose who to take with her. So my cousin got left in the war, and that's just hard to record. But now I take refuge in prayer, kind of like finding God in the phone book. It came to me sounding something like a song hook, saying, heaven.
Kanan's cousin got out of Somalia last year and now lives in the U.S. Kanan is not a newcomer to hip-hop. His first CD, The Dusty Foot Philosopher, was a hit with critics here and abroad. His new CD, Troubadour, features Mos Def and Damian Marley. The LA Times recently listed Kanan as an artist to watch in 2009. The Guardian newspaper called him powerfully low-key, theatrical, and witty. Saleh Mohammed is not a music critic, but like Kanan, he knows all about growing up in extreme circumstances.
I think one of the things that I'm drawn to Kanan music, he lives it. He talks about the truth.
Salim Mohammed grew up in an orphanage in Kenya. Today, he's a community organizer in Kibera, one of the biggest slums in East Africa. He met Kanan when they worked on a cable TV show together.
He just doesn't sing for himself. He sings for us. That's the most important thing. And when you hear him speaking, it's a voice of so many coming out of him.
There's no way to write it, there's no way to fight it. And I kick and scream, but you got me despite it. And I got my pride, so I begin to hide it. Like fire in Freetown, you begin to light it.
Kanan writes in a variety of music styles. But before he moved to North America, before he spoke any English, his first love was American rap.
I came to the door, I said it before, I never let the mic magnetize me no more, but it's right. Eric B and Rakim, Paid in Full. I had it memorized just like that. But of course, I didn't know what door meant.
Kanan could not be mistaken for an American rapper, at least not a gangsta rapper. He wears no bling, though he is stylish. He has a kind of vintage bohemian look. Kanan doesn't think American gangster rap has much credibility, because even the toughest American neighborhoods aren't nearly as dangerous as Mogadishu.
Where rocket-propelled grenades are fired around you on a daily, you know, a guy bragging about standing on TV and talking about how gangster he is and how he'll do it. For us, it's more a source of entertainment. It's more like a comedy or something that we watch and we say, oh wow, that's kind of cute of American gangsters or something. But it isn't hardcore. It isn't that bad. You know, it's like, let's get things in perspective, you know.
Lately, Kanan has been talking about the Somali pirates who've been hijacking ships from Western countries off the Somali coast, because he says there's more to that story, too. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You can download Kanan's song, Somalia, and hear more of his music at nprmusic.org. In fact, why wait?
It was a hum from a poet whose pulse fell drum, drum, drum.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inske.
Greed and lies too. Yeah, confusing days, they moved in ways, it soon became a coon. Boom, boom, boom. And knock on his door, his heart is no more. And knock on his door, his soul is no more.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. I confess, I don't remember much about trying to learn to play the piano. But I do remember, some 40 years later, that the lines on the treble clef staff correspond to the first letters of Every Good Boy Does Fine. For the bass clef, Great Big Dreams for America. These are mnemonic devices, memory jogs. And Christopher Stevens has compiled a bunch of them in his small book, 30 Days Has September. For example, if you're ever called on to name the main royal families who've ruled England over the last millennium, keep this mnemonic in mind.
No point letting your trousers slip halfway. It's slightly rude, and it's very silly, and it's very simple.
You'd probably remember it. No doubt.
It sticks in the mind, doesn't it?
Well, then, though, you have to remember, well, okay,
now
so P
you have
is Plantagenet,
so
and L is Lancaster.
Exactly. The key is that it's the first letter of each word. So no point is NP. And that reminds you that the first two royal families were Norman and Plantagenet, which is a great English name. It's with a P. The next one, Letting for Lancaster, Your for York, Trousers, T for Tudor, Henry VIII and his lot, Slip, Stuart, and then the Hanovers for Halfway. The Hanovers are still here, but with a German name, they decided that it was a little bit politically incorrect to have a German name. They changed it to the much more English Windsor.
And that's where you are with the last word, way.
They are Windsors now, so... That's where no point letting your trousers slip halfway. That's what that gets you.
And did you make up that mnemonic, or is this something that school kids around Britain would be taught from the beginning?
Most of these mnemonics are things that have been handed down for a long time. Some of them are centuries old. I'll tell you the quick one. If you need to know the four heads on Mount Rushmore, think we just like Rushmore. That's W, Washington, J, Jefferson, L, Lincoln, and R, Roosevelt.
Where did the idea for this book come from, and what demographic are you aiming this toward?
It's aimed primarily at children because it's come out of quite an intense educational experience which my family has gone through over the last 10 or 15 years. My older son, James, is sitting with me at the moment, very quietly in the studio. We haven't brought his younger brother, who is 12 years old, who wouldn't be sitting quietly. He's a very profoundly autistic boy named David. He's a lovely lad, but he can't communicate. He can't understand spoken language or sign language, and learning to educate him has been a very steep curve for us indeed. What we discovered was that different parts of his brain do work very well. One of the parts that works well is his musical intelligence. He can recognise thousands of tunes. Despite the fact that he can't understand what the words of the songs might be, he can imitate the sounds of the songs, including the words, by reproducing them with that musical part of his mind. Mm. And the psychologist suggested that we should start applying music to everything in his life. And that began with very, very simple things, like when he was to take a bath. He always enjoyed his bath, but it always started with a terrible panic because he didn't know what was coming next. And the same happened for going out of the house and getting into the car. Stepping outside of the house was like stepping out of the airlock in a rocket ship for him and going into outer space. He had no idea what was coming next. For all he knew, it was the most desperate peril that he was being taken into. What we did was we sang a song which applied only to that situation. David's riding in the blue car, David's riding in the blue car. It was a Woody Guthrie song originally. Mm. And for having a bath, it was just a simple splish, splash, splish, splash, splosh, take a bath. And we'd sing that as we were going up the stairs. After he'd done that once or twice, he twigged. He got it completely. And he started doing the same, applying songs to virtually every situation you can imagine. Even though he wasn't communicating it to us, we could tell what he was thinking because of what he was singing. So there was a song from a favourite puppet show that went, Windy Miller, Windy Miller. And that meant it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm sneaking downstairs to find something to break.
I see.
So when you heard Windy Miller, you knew you had to move fast.
That was your mnemonic device.
That was exactly. That's a mnemonic device. And through learning to apply these to David, we realised that all children can use the whole of their brains. David, unfortunately, can't use the spoken word, but that doesn't mean that a child who can use spoken word should only use spoken word. Why not switch on all those other parts of the brain, the bits that are working so well with David, and let an ordinary child access that kind of intelligence? And it's amazing how much easier it is to learn and to remember if you use a wide spectrum of your mind.
You know, one of my favorite, it's not really a mnemonic, but it's a sort of a trick in your book, is for kids who are learning their nine times tables. And if I was taught this when I was little, I don't remember it, but it's great.
Yeah, James taught me this one. My older son taught me this one. This is astonishing. Hold out your hands, palms down, stretch your fingers and thumbs out. Now, if you want to know the answer to any of the nine times table, count your fingers off from left to right. Curl down your little finger, your pinky finger on your left hand, so that you're left with nine fingers up, yeah? So you've got one down and nine up. So one times nine is nine. That's simple. But then fingers out, stretched out again, and now curl down your ring finger, the second finger. You've got two down, and that leaves, to the right of that, that leaves eight up.
Right, so this is nine times two.
Yeah.
Which will, of course, 18.
And then the third one down gives you 2, 7. Fourth one down gives you 3 and 6, which is 36. Four nines are 36, and so on.
Right, so it's the fingers to the left of the one that's down that make the tens column, the fingers to the right that make the ones column. And you sort of, your fingers get kind of crampy trying to do this, but it works. It's a fun way to learn your nine times tables. Well, Christopher Stevens, thanks very much for sharing your mnemonics.
Lovely to talk to you, Melissa.
Christopher Stevens, his book is 30 Days Has September, Cool Ways to Remember Stuff.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Ask teenagers how they feel about high school, and you're likely to hear a variation on this theme.
High school was just boring.
And I was bored out of my mind.
Public school was really boring.
Those students found a way out of their boredom. They went straight to college without ever getting a high school diploma. NPR's Larry Abramson paid a visit to Bard College at Simon's Rock, where 15-year-olds can start work on a bachelor's degree.
The concept of Simon's Rock is simple. The last 2 years of high school are a waste of time, so go straight to college. Robin Caskey is only 18 years old, and she's about to get her associate's degree.
In high school, you're done basically with your education junior year for the type of student I was, and then senior year is about writing your applications and sending them out during Christmas break and then waiting and crossing your fingers and hoping you'll get in.
Caskey is sitting in the student union, which looks out on this beautiful wooded campus in western Massachusetts. She is proof of the Simon's Rock concept. Caskey felt totally ready for college-level work when she arrived here after her sophomore year in high school. Like other kids here, Caskey says moving away from home that young was not a big deal, but one thing did surprise her.
I don't know, it was a bit of an adjustment coming freshman year and realizing that you're not the smartest kid in the room anymore. I was used to being the girl that dominated the conversation or got the top score on any test I was taking, and here that's just not the case, and I don't think that's the focus either.
The focus is on small classes and strong teaching.
Who else lets go the great wheel?
Gonalyn Regan.
Okay.
Before Hal Holliday arrives to teach, his students tell me he is awesome. For 90 minutes, he and 10 students discuss the play, seminar style, the way they would on any college campus.
They're horrible.
This is clearly college, not high school. No time is wasted on discipline, on announcements or attendance. Simon's Rock Dean Sam Arumkorf says kids here are treated like adults, so that's how they act.
Taking our students absolutely seriously, intellectually. And we recognize that they're 15, 16, or 17, but we respect their opinions. We let them argue with us, overrule us. We want to know what they think.
Kids may be treated like adults academically, but when it comes to dorm life, they're treated more like teenagers, with closer supervision than at a typical college. But administrators say discipline is less of a problem when nearly everyone on campus wants to be here. That's the real force that holds things together. Oh, and there's no time to get into too much trouble.
So what are you doing on the weekends?
Homework.
A gaggle of girls is picking at the food from the school cafeteria. There's only one place to eat here. Leah Selitsky, 16, is eating lunch with her fur hat on. She says many of the social pressures of high school disappear at Simon's Rock.
In high school, everything is grades or everything is marijuana. And here, the kids who work really hard don't do it for grades. They do it because they love learning. The difference is huge.
Mindy Iser was an honor student in high school, but she says she was getting terrible grades. Then at Simon's Rock, she met her advisor, who is apparently some sort of superhero.
She is the smartest, most amazing woman, nicest, most... her brain is like this big. I feel like if I don't know something or if I didn't do the reading, I would be personally letting her down.
All these small classes and close relationships cost money. Tuition is $50,000 a year. 80% of kids get some sort of financial aid, but many students said they weren't sure their parents could afford to keep them here. Now, this place is not for everyone. That goes for teachers, too. They are intimately responsible for a small group of students. For Gidon Eschel, who came from the University of Chicago to teach environmental science, the difference was day and night.
Well, at Chicago, I mean, they can tell you whatever they want, but really, teaching is totally irrelevant. I mean, nobody spends any innovative effort to teach. Here, it's very different.
Different and a little lonely. Gidon Eschel says at Chicago he could find bright people in his field around every corner.
There isn't anybody in my field here. I'm totally alone.
Simon's Rock sees itself as a unique outpost, a quirky survivor from the 60s reform efforts that gave birth to this school. In recent years, the school has helped to foster dozens of early college programs around the country. Simon's Rock teaches seminars on early college pedagogy. But the school remains an odd duck, an enduring experiment that's tough to replicate. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Okay, so it's a little tougher to find a job at the post office. There is another way that you can find employment, though. Get on the FBI's most wanted list, which might be posted at the post office. No, not that list. There is another list. It's a list of open jobs, and that's the subject of our last word in business today. The FBI needs to fill 850 special agent positions. It also has openings for more than 2,000 support staff. Officials say this is the agency's largest job posting since just after 9/11. Attrition and a wave of retirements are the reasons. And that means another generation has a chance to search for the people on that other most wanted list. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The nation's third largest employer is losing money. If you want to help, write a letter. Tamara Keith reports on the plight of the U.S. Postal Service.
Thousands of identical envelopes fly through a barcode sorting machine at a Washington, D.C. postal facility. It's mostly ads and solicitations, asking for charitable donations or offering new credit cards. And it's mail like this that told the U.S. Postal Service that the economy was in trouble. Way back in December of 2007.
We noticed a big drop-off in our mail volume beginning, and then it accelerated throughout the year.
Stephen Carney is Senior Vice President of Customer Relations for the Postal Service.
Our mail volume had its biggest decline since the Great Depression.
In the fiscal year that ended in September, mail carriers delivered 9.5 billion fewer letters and packages than the year before. Carney says the Postal Service made aggressive cuts and still lost $2.8 billion. Fiscal year 2009, which started October 1st, he says isn't looking any better.
We may have losses that are larger than the $2.8 billion we had last year. Revenue is not doing well so far in October and November.
Mail volume always suffers when the economy suffers, but this economic downturn is hitting the Postal Service particularly hard. That's because the slumping housing and financial sectors have typically been big users of direct mail marketing. In the third quarter, credit card offers were down 30% from the year before. That's according to data from the tracking firm Mintel Compromedia. Stephen Clifford is a company vice president.
Lenders and credit card issuers need to be more selective about who they're mailing offers to, so that's down.
Plus, he says direct mail marketing isn't cheap.
You send less mail, you spend less money.
And it's not just corporations. Postal Service officials say people sent fewer holiday cards and packages last year. More people are paying their bills online. There's even a do not mail movement urging people to protect the environment by skipping catalogs and paper statements. Dan Blair, chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission, says this recession is forcing the Postal Service to evolve.
The question remains is, will consumers come back to using the mail? And more importantly, will the banks, or will the credit card companies, will the financial institutions continue to use the mail? Are they going to look to using the internet as a means of communicating with their customers?
And if they don't come back, Blair says the Postal Service and Congress may have to more seriously consider some cost-cutting ideas that have been out there for a while.
For instance, are they going to be able to continue six-day-a-week delivery? Are they going to be able to keep all those small post offices operating?
For now, Stephen Carney says the Postal Service is adjusting routes to reflect the reduced mail volume, offering early retirement to employees, and changing operations at sorting facilities from 24 hours a day to 18. There haven't been any layoffs, but through the trims, the Postal Service has cut the equivalent of more than 20,000 jobs.
A lot of people have predicted the demise of the Postal Service many times before, including after the invention of the telegraph, the telephone, and the fax machine. And we think when the economy recovers, demand for our shipping and mailing services will be renewed.
And when the economy does recover, Carney says the Postal Service should be among the first to know, since mail volume is what you might call a lesser-known leading economic indicator. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith.
This is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Why should you adopt a black cat instead of an orange one? Do dogs need a pack leader or a papa? And how do you draw blood from an antelope without terrifying it? These are some of the questions author and animal advocate Temple Grandin answers in her new book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Temple Grandin joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here.
The thesis of your book is that there are basically four core emotional systems at work in both humans and animals. Could you give us a brief overview of these four emotional systems?
Now, these were emotional systems originally identified by Jack Panskap, a neuroscientist, and they are fear, rage, panic or separation anxiety, and goal-directed seeking behavior. You know, when you look at behavior, you got to go, okay, what emotion would be driving that behavior? And I also would like to give credit to my co-author, Katherine Johnson, on coming up with the idea of linking the core emotions to a lot of abnormal behaviors, like animals maybe chewing something up, or, you know, they're really aggressive, or they're scared and they're cowering in the corner.
And so the basic philosophy that you write about, which seems to make a lot of sense, is you stimulate this seeking mode and the play mode, and you try to avoid things like rage and fear in an animal. So let's talk a little bit about some specific animals and some theories you outline. One animal you write a chapter about is cats and how to read their emotions. And you note a really interesting point. Cats don't have eyebrows. Why should that matter?
Well, they don't have the expressive faces that dogs have. I mean, dogs, you can kind of tell what they're thinking. If you want to train a cat, the best way to do it is with clicker training, using food as a motivator, where a dog will do stuff for you just because he wants to do it, just for the social reward.
I thought it was fascinating that you suggest that when you're adopting a cat, there's certain things you might want to consider, and one of those things is color. And why is it there's certain gene traits that you're looking at that supports this idea that the black cats might be more laid back? Could you explain that?
Well, it's hard to explain why that would be connected to temperament, but I found in cattle, for example, that the little hair whorls that cattle and horses have on their forehead is connected to temperament. Animals that have a hair whorl that's high up on the forehead tend to startle easily, and they're more excitable. And then animals such as the red cats, the marmalade cats, very, very affectionate, but startle really easily.
I am a dog owner, so I have to confess I was particularly interested in the dog chapter. And you wrote a lot about the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan, and his theory that's become very popular is that owners need to be this kind of dominant pack leader. But you don't entirely agree with that. What were some of the findings you had there about how we should behave with our dogs?
Well, I think if you look at wolves, you know, you don't have a whole bunch of unrelated wolves living together. You know, they actually are family units. And I think in a really artificial situation that we've created for dogs, you know, some of Caesar's methods work. But when I was a child and all the dogs just ran around loose, you know, a young dog came into somebody's house. He got socialized, you know, with the other dogs. We didn't have all the dog bites. Now, the downside is a lot of dogs were killed by cars. That was the bad part. But the dogs had, in some ways, a better quality of life, because dogs need to be socialized with other dogs, not just to people. So they kind of learn the give and take of social behavior.
These emotions that you write about, there's a basic premise throughout this book that animals do have an emotion. And I think that some critics might argue that that's anthropomorphizing a bit too much. What sort of evidence can you point to that animals really do have emotions and that they're emotions similar to humans?
Well, in the subcortical brain systems that all mammals have, it's hard neuroscience. The fear circuits, for example, were traced and documented 25 years ago. You know, Prozac works on dogs. You know, if there wasn't some similarity between dog emotion and our emotion, then why would Prozac work on dogs? And you look at how the brain systems are set up, especially in the subcortical parts of the brain, the older, more primitive parts of the brain, it's set up the same way with the same neurotransmitter substances.
I'd like to ask about your chapter on zoos, and you write about a trend that zoos have been following lately to try to make enclosures that seem natural for animals in the wild. But you write that this isn't necessarily in their best interest. Why not?
Well, you could, if you just make an enclosure that's just a bunch of concrete rocks that looks pretty, it's still just as barren as a barren cage. You've got to give the animal the things it needs. Okay, let's take an animal that a lot of people are familiar with, like the gerbil, for example. Sometimes gerbils will get into stereotypic digging. Dig, 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 dig. So someone might say, well, let's just give the gerbil, you know, more dirt to dig in. Well, he still digs and digs. But the reason why he's digging is he wants cover. This is an animal that out in the wild wants to get under things so the hawks and the predators aren't going to eat it up. What he wants is cover. And if you give him some tunnels already dug to give him cover, then he doesn't dig. Why is the polar bear pacing? What does the polar bear do out in nature? He walks tremendous big long distances seeking. So then you got to Give him something to seek. It's going to be different with different animals.
There's an anecdote in this book about a zoo that was having tremendous difficulty getting antelope from the barn where they slept every night to their exhibit at the zoo. And they had to pass through this alley. And you described that, that there were days that they just were struck with tremendous fear. Other days they were fine. And the zoo brought you out to investigate. What did you find?
Well, there was this stupid yellow sign that said danger electrical panel. And it wasn't fastened to the electrical panel. It was leaning up against the fence. And it was out in the middle of the alley, just laying upside down with the yellow back of the sign showing. And I go, they're afraid of that sign.
And no one else had noticed it but you.
No. You've got to be observant of the little things the animal tends to notice. And I said, look, either fasten that sign permanently to the fence, or I'm going to take it, throw it out in the bushes, and we're going to just get rid of it. Because I think this is what your problem is.
And it worked.
Yeah. And it worked. You've got to look for those kinds of things.
This book covers so many different animals, and not everyone can be a full-time animal researcher. But for people listening who want to take away from this just one thing that they can do at home with their animals, whatever their animal might be, what piece of advice would you give?
Well, if it's a pet animal, dogs need a lot of attention. They just don't handle being alone very well. If you do have to be away at work all day, and get somebody else to come over and, you know, take your dog out and play with them, and dogs need a lot of stuff to do.
The title of this book, Animals Make Us Human, I'm wondering if you can think back to a recent experience in all the work that you do with animals where an animal made you more human.
Well, that's a hard question. Right now when you ask me that, I'm seeing Mark's little red dog right now. I'm seeing Cheryl, my assistant's border collie. She just loves to see me. Mark works for me. He does designing and drafting work for cattle ranches now. But Mark used to have a little blue heeler dog. Then whenever I went over to his house, Annie would just roll on her back, and she just wanted lots and lots and lots of petting. She really enjoyed all that petting, and I enjoyed giving her that petting. And I want to tell you, it should be stroking, not patting, but stroking. A lot of animals interpret pats as hits.
And petting the dogs makes you feel more human? How?
Well, it just makes me feel good. Like, Annie really liked having me stroke her on the belly. And she always wanted to see me, too.
Temple Grandin is professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's also author of the new book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Thank you, Temple.
Well, thank you for having me.
For more advice from Temple Grandin, check out our blog at npr.org/daydreaming. There you can read about how I tried some of her tips with my puppy Sadie. You can also share your own pet training notes. It's all at our blog, npr.org/daydreaming.